Isaiah 53, The Man of Sorrows, the 18th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 24, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I'm going to start in 52:13 and go to the end of chapter 53 of Isaiah. I'm not exactly sure how to teach this, but I'll just launch out and try it. What I have is a, I don't know if I should call this a translation. It's sort of a translation, but my Hebrew is pretty rusty, so I relied very heavily on the New American Standard Version and pretended like it knew what it was doing for most of the chapter. And then I just looked up a few things and studied a few things on my own. There may not be quite enough of these for everybody, so those of you who can share, if you could share, then I think it'll make it all the way around. I'll wait and see how this goes. The reason I say I'm not quite sure how to teach this is that I think the work in teaching it is on this page here. Once you decide what's going on in the chapter, it's really pretty straightforward. It's not really all that complicated once you figure out what's going on. The task of figuring out what's going on is very difficult, I think. But I've tried to share my conclusions in that regard here in this translation here. We'll get to this in a second, but I think there's no way we can understand what's going on in Isaiah without remembering the history, how we get to where we get when we get to Isaiah. And the passages that we've been looking at in previous weeks are all building up to and trying to give us the fragments, the pieces of the picture that we need to keep in mind as we come to the book of Isaiah. Let me just review them briefly. You have this man in Ur of Chaldea named Abram. And God, Yahweh, appears to him, makes him a promise, tells him to go to a land that he doesn't know, that he's going to show him. Abraham obeys the voice of God, goes to this land. When he gets to this land, God makes him a promise, says, I'm going to give this land to your seed. Having already promised him, Abraham, I'm going to bless you, and in you all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. I think keep that in mind. From the New Testament perspective, that promise to Abraham is the most important promise of all, the blessing of Abraham, the fact that God is going to do something amazing, something remarkable, something valuable for Abraham, and not only for Abraham, but to people who enter into some kind of familial relationship with Abraham, even those who are not literally physically descended from him. But people who become his children in a spiritual sense, all people from all over the world, all nations, all tribes, all peoples, are going to share in this blessing, this wonderful thing that God is going to give to Abraham, he's going to give to these other people as well. But that was only one side of the promise to Abraham. The other side of the promise to Abraham was to Abraham and his physical descendants, who were literally and truly and strictly his physical descendants. And to those, God said, I'm going to give you this land, and when he was in Palestine, in Canaan. And I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to give you this land. I am going to be a God to them, and they are going to be my people, and I'm going to be their God. Then you have a significant period of time pass without God really doing much about that, other than just reiterating this promise to Abraham's child and then his grandchild. And then they go into the people go to Egypt. They become enslaved in Egypt, and things are not looking all that good. God has made these promises, but they're just promises at this point. God has not acted to do anything to form them into a people where they are the people of God and God is their God. That's why the Exodus event, where God comes and takes the people out of Egypt, delivers them from bondage into Egypt, takes them out into the wilderness, and in the wilderness he basically initiates this covenant with the people, establishing the fact that he's going to be their God, they're going to be his people, and these are going to be the terms upon which that relationship is going to be founded. And that's the covenant that he made with the people. We call it the Mosaic Covenant. Do this, God says to them, do these things, keep my ordinances, my judgments, my commandments, my precepts, keep these things, and I will take you into the land and you will prosper. Don't do these things, and the land is going to vomit you out. So he made that covenant with the people, and at the same time that he was making the covenant with the people, Moses in Deuteronomy, for example, says, and you know what's going to happen? I'm going to take you into the land, and I'm going to drive out the enemies before you, and I'm going to secure the land for you, and I'm going to give you vineyards that you didn't plant and houses that you didn't build, and you're going to drink from cisterns that you didn't dig. And what's going to happen is you're going to say in your heart, I dug that cistern, I planted that vineyard, I built that house. And you're going to forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. And you're going to worship other gods. And eventually the land is going to vomit you out. In other words, Moses was predicting right up front, you people aren't going to do this. You don't believe me, you don't love God, you don't know God, you're not going to keep his commandments. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. But it took a considerable amount of time. God worked with the people of Israel. He sent prophets to rebuke them, to exhort them, to teach them. He kept trying to woo them back to him, to live in this faithful relationship with him and to keep his covenants and so on. He sent judges first, and then prophets. But after a number of years, and then you had this whole thing where what they needed was a king. We just need a king. God says, you want a king? I'll give you a king. He gave them a king. The first one didn't work out so well. Then came David. And God established, anointed David as king through the prophet Nathan. And then not only that, but he did a really amazing thing. We've been looking at that the last 2 weeks. He did this really amazing thing. He said, David, your throne I'm going to establish forever. This is going to be an eternal kingdom. Your seed will sit on the throne forever, and I'm going to build a unique relationship with the king from the line of David. I am going to be a God to him, and he's going to be a son to me. Now, I'm not sure. Well, no, I guess we did. One thing that we have to be clear on in that relationship of I'm going to be a God to you and he will be a son to me, is that part of what that means is, as the son, he's going to be in a position to represent God himself, the authority of God himself. And so the king of Israel was established as the very throne of God himself on the earth. But there were all kinds of grand promises about this son who was to come, this Mashiach, this anointed one, who was going to come and rule with the very authority of God himself. And the promises, it became pretty clear, far outran the quality of the people who sat in the throne of David after him. They didn't even love God. They didn't even know God. They didn't obey him. They worshipped other gods, most of them. There were rare kings who worshipped Yahweh and only Yahweh, but they were relatively rare. Most of them worshipped foreign gods. So it became pretty clear that this wasn't working, that this is not what God had in mind. These dudes weren't going to fulfill the promises that God made to David about his dynasty, about his king, about his throne. And eventually it became pretty clear that the whole nation was in jeopardy. So what do we have? And that's where Isaiah comes on the scene. So what do we have? We have a promise that was made ages past to their father Abraham, that he was going to bless Abraham, and through Abraham, and by being a part of Abraham's family, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. You have a promise that God made with the unique descendants, physical descendants of Abraham, that God is going to make them a unique people on the face of the earth, a people unlike any other people on the face of the earth who are going to have a special, intimate relationship with God. He's promised them that. It's never come to pass. It's never really been realized in the way God had intended it to, but it's a promise there, nonetheless. And what I would argue is, it's still going to happen in our future. It still has yet to be fulfilled. But it's a promise there, hanging out there in the air. You have the promise of a king who's going to come and who is going to rule for God with the very authority of God himself, ruling in righteousness, establishing justice in the kingdom that he's going to set up. So you have these fragments of promises. I don't know. Maybe it's clear how those promises are all supposed to fit together. I don't know how someone like Isaiah would have seen those things. But certainly they're huge pieces of what God has promised that he's going to do in relationship to mankind in general and the nation of Israel in particular. But what we have when we get to Isaiah is we have an unbelieving, corrupt, disobedient, other God-worshipping people. God has announced through a number of prophets that he's fed up with them, that he's had it up to here with their disobedience. And then through Isaiah, he begins to predict that it's too late, you guys have stepped over the line, I'm getting Babylon ready, they're going to come in and they're going to devastate you, take away your nation, take away your temple, they're going to completely decimate your nation, your land, and your culture right now. They're gonna take this down. They're going to take this apart. It has not happened yet, but Isaiah is predicting that in the earlier part of Isaiah. Then what happens in the latter part of Isaiah's prophecies is that Isaiah, before Babylon is even a significant state, a significant military power in the world. Remember, he's writing these things, he's having these visions or having these revelations and recording these revelations before Babylon is even a world power. I mean, I suppose it would be like some prophet coming along and saying, what?
Uruguay is going to wipe us out.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, something like that. That's good. I was thinking Antarctica, but... So that's when he's writing. Now in these prophecies surrounding the one that we're going to look at tonight, he's beginning to make predictions about not only the captivity, but the return from captivity. And he's exulting in the joy and the wonder and the marvel at the faithfulness of God and the loyalty of God, that God would come and restore them back to the land having been taken into captivity. Okay, before we even get into Isaiah 52 and 53, I want to make a point here that has just struck me as really important. We don't really understand what's going on here until we understand this. One of the prophecies of Isaiah begins, "Comfort, comfort, O my people." That a lot of these prophecies are intended to be an encouragement, to be a comfort to the nation of Israel. But the thing that's so amazing is it, think about the nature of the comfort that he's offering. He's just told them, you know what's going to happen? The Babylonians are going to come along, and some of you are going to see your homes destroyed, your family split up, your children killed. It's going to be an economic disaster for you. You're going to experience nothing but misery and pain. But I've got some good news for you. After 70 years there, God's going to bring you back. After 7 years in captivity, God's going to bring you back. Now, notice what kind of odd person you need to be to take comfort in that. I mean, you see how odd that is? Unless you are a person who cares more about God being God, God being the living God who is the God of Israel, who is in control of history, and God's promises being kept in the world, and recognizing that your existence transcends this present age in such a way that you're going to benefit in the end by God's promises being kept. Unless you have that outlook and that perspective, none of this is comforting. You see what I'm saying? So if anyone who has a worldly perspective, whose concerns are, I don't want to hurt, I don't want to suffer, I don't want to experience any economic deprivation, I just don't want to be bothered at all, then nothing in Isaiah's prophecy is of any benefit whatsoever, if you're worldly. But if your perspective transcends your this, here, and now worldly existence to something grander, to something bigger, to something transcendent, and you recognize that the meaning of my life is in the history of what God is doing in relationship to all of mankind and what that means for me as an individual, then this becomes incredibly vital information. Because to a person who's not worldly, the thing that's devastating about Babylon coming and wiping out Israel is not the economic and physical and material devastation. That's not really the big deal. The big deal is it makes it a whole lot more difficult to see that God's promises are going to get kept. But God, you are going to establish a kingdom here. And you're taking away all of our leaders, and you're taking away all of our people, and you're removing us off the land, the very land that you promised to Abraham. You're making it really hard on yourself, God. And you still want me to believe that this is what you're doing, that this is what you're up to, that this is how history is going to go down, is that you are going to establish us in the land and give us a king and give us a kingdom and so on and so forth. It's scary to a person of faith to see history going the opposite direction from the way God promised that it was going to go. To that person who's scared by that, the prophet comes along and says, no, now, wait, time out. God is a faithful God. He's a loyal God. He's going to keep his promises. This is just a temporary little thing here. You guys didn't keep your Sabbaths, so you're going to pay for it. I'm disciplining my children. I'm doing a little re-education here. But that's all it is. And I wouldn't for a second let those Babylonians tromp on you, except that you need to learn your lesson. You need to be chastised. But that's all that's going on here. But don't think for a minute that I have forsaken you. Don't think for a minute that I'm not serious about keeping the promises that I made to your fathers. I'm going to keep them. And then he gets specific. It's going to be 70 years And then this is going to happen. Then you're going to, a voice calling in the wilderness, make way, make ready the way for God as he leads the people from Babylon back into Palestine and so on. Well, 52, the first part of 52 is all about calling the people back out of Babylon. The very thing that I was just talking about. But now we get to verse 15 of chapter 52, and that's where your handout takes off. Now, if you just read this straight through, that Isaiah doesn't give you any sort of clue about who's speaking, who he's speaking to, or anything like that. So what I've tried to do is I've given you my best judgment about what I think is going on here. And what you find is 52:13 through 53:12 all fits together as a piece, I think, in Isaiah's prophecies. And what you have is God speaking at the beginning, and God speaking at the end, Yahweh himself speaking about this person that he calls, this person or whatever, that he calls my servant. Sandwiched in between that, the question is, who's speaking there? Who's talking from 53:1 and following? And my best guess is that the way to understand this is that it's some kind of disembodied, anonymous voice that is the identity of which is not really all that important, and I don't even think is intended to be specific. It's not anyone with a specific identity. More importantly, it's a person at a specific point in time. Namely, it's a voice of someone who is looking back in time on the life of this one called my servant. So it could be anybody. It could be an apostle, for example. It could just be a neutral, dispassionate observer to this scene. Well, I don't know about that, but it's not any specific individual, but it's someone who has already observed in history this person that he calls my servant and is looking back on that person, my servant, and his relationship to his generation. In other words, what's crucial throughout this whole section is how did the generation that saw the coming of the servant, how did they interact with him? How did they respond to him? What did they do with him? And in fact, that's what I would argue. The New Testament writers understand Isaiah to be commenting on how Isaiah predicted that Jesus' own generation was not going to be very impressed. And Isaiah is predicting that here. That's how the New Testament authors understand that. So let me just read through here and make some comments as we go along, and then I'll open it up for questions, and I might have a couple more points to make. If you want to compare this with whatever English translation you have and ask me about why I went the way I did on my translation, feel free to do that. But otherwise, I'm going to ignore the other translations and just work from this page. Take note of this. Take note of this. My servant will have understanding. Consequently, he will be lifted up and exalted. He will be greatly glorified. Just as many were scandalized by you, O Israel, due to the shortcomings in his appearance in the eyes of man, due to the shortcomings of his form in the eyes of the sons of men, so too will my servant prove offensive to the many nations. Even so, kings will shut their mouths and be silent on account of him, for what had not been told to them, that they will see, and what they had not heard, that they will understand. Okay, now this is God speaking about his servant. The first thing that he says is, my servant, something like, my servant will have understanding. The translators really have fits with how to translate this, and maybe I've got this wrong, but the word that's used here is just the basic fundamental word for wisdom, and wisdom and understanding in the Hebrew. And I'm just taking it at face value. It seems to me that what he's saying is, this servant that he's talking about is someone who's going to know what's coming down. It's someone who's going to know what God is up to in history. It's someone who's going to have wisdom about who God is, what his purposes and plans are in history, and he's going to have access to that information and be able to teach that to us. If the New Testament is right, that this servant that he's talking about is Jesus, then it's completely consistent with their picture of Jesus. Jesus is the last prophet. Jesus is the prophet of prophets. Jesus is the one who had all the pieces and was able to put them together for us. He was the one who taught us what life and reality was all about, finally. And that's the way I would take this. My servant will have understanding is not, it's not just this kind of token compliment. He means that in the literal sense of the word. This is somebody who's going to have understanding of what God is up to like no one else has ever understood it. He's going to be the revealer, the one to reveal the purposes of God to us. It's what Paul is talking about in the letter of Hebrews when he says, in past times God has spoken to the fathers in many portions and in many ways, but in these last days he has spoken to us through his Son. Well, what does he mean, he has spoken to us through his Son? Well, what he means is Jesus came along and taught us what all the prophets were getting at. Jesus is the one who taught us what this was all about, because he's the one who understood. So take note of this. My servant will have understanding. Consequently, he will be lifted up and exalted. He will be greatly glorified. He's going to be a big deal and have the corresponding glory that should go with that. But he goes on to say, just as many were scandalized by you, it's not clear who the you is, I've supplied it. I'm inclined to think that he's speaking to Israel here. Just as many were scandalized by you, O Israel. Now, what is he getting at? I can't remember where it is, but God says to Israel at one point through one of the prophets, or maybe it's in even Deuteronomy, you were an insignificant people, you were nothing, but God chose you and made you the apple of his eye or something like that. He didn't choose you because you were a mighty nation. He didn't choose you because you were a big deal. I think that's what he's getting at here. You know, the rest of the world looking on at God choosing Israel, if you were to take the world powers at that time, would have laughed. They would have been literally scandalized by it. God, do you know what you're doing? What on earth are you doing? They're an insignificant nomadic people. They don't have anything to offer you. They're no big deal. They're not powerful. They're not wise. They're not great. What are you doing? You're picking these nothing people to be the unique people to relate to you uniquely, God? Well, what he's saying is, just as they were scandalized by you, O Israel, due to the shortcomings in his appearance in the eyes of man, due to the shortcomings of his form in the eyes of the sons of man, so too will my servant prove offensive to the nations, to many nations. In other words, what God is saying is, I'm going to do with my servant the same thing I've done with you. I'm not going to bring someone into the world who's a big deal. I'm not going to bring somebody into the world who is physically and economically and politically and socially powerful and great and magnificent and marvelous, someone who recommends himself to anybody because he's so dazzling in his glory. I'm going to take someone who's virtually invisible for his insignificance, but he's going to be my servant. He's the one that I've chosen, and he's the one that I'm going to pick, and he's going to be insignificant just like you, Israel. We're insignificant among the peoples of the earth. I'm going to do the same thing with the servant that I've done with you. And he talks about his deficiencies or his shortcomings in the eyes of man. That is, from what perspective is his servant inadequate? Well, from the perspective of normal human perception. What is it that we look for? We look for charisma, we look for power, we look for beauty, we look for fame, we look for, you know what we look for. All that stuff that we look for, Jesus didn't have. But wisdom, understanding, love for God, knowledge of God, that's the stuff that ultimately really matters. But that stuff's not valuable to us naturally. Naturally, we're looking for other stuff. So we're going to look right past the servant of God, the servant of Yahweh, if we're looking for the good stuff. Unimportant God stuff that makes him really important that we're not even going to look at. We're not even going to consider that. So he says, my servant is going to prove offensive to many nations. Most of the Gentiles, most of the nations of the earth are not going to be at all impressed with Jesus. You know, just this Palestinian peasant who said some things that got some people mad at him, and he got crucified and executed and probably didn't even exist anyway. That's what most Gentiles are going to think about Jesus. But even though he'll prove offensive to the many nations, yet, nonetheless, at the same time, even kings will shut their mouths and be silent on account of him. For what had not been told to them, that they will see, and what they had not heard, that they will understand. Now, you see what he's saying? Jesus, in his earthly ministry, came to the people of Israel and proclaimed the coming of the kingdom of God to the people of Israel. They're the ones that heard. They were the ones that saw. For the most part, they are not the ones who believed. Not yet. At least still at this point in history, the nation of Israel, for the most part, except for what Paul in the New Testament calls a remnant, for the most part, Israel has looked right past Jesus. He's been invisible to them. Nah, he's not it. He's not what we want. But that's not true in the Gentile world. In the Gentile world, as much as for the most part the Gentiles have not bought Jesus either, yet at least Jesus has had a significant impact on the Gentile world. Even kings have shut their mouths at Jesus. What had not been told to them, that is, they didn't hear Jesus teach. You know, they didn't walk around with Jesus as part of his disciples and listen to him teach. But nonetheless, somehow, by the miracle of God opening their eyes and opening their ears, somehow some of these people in the nations have believed, have seen what was not told them, and have understood what they did not hear. I think basically this is a prediction of the impact of Christianity in the Gentile world subsequent to the teaching of Jesus. By some strange mysterious process, divine process of God, those of us who did not have the benefit of hearing Jesus teach in person and watching his miracles and watching him give his own credentials for his own role in ministry, we have somehow found our way to believe anybody anyway. Whereas the very generation who saw him and heard him rejected him. An amazing and remarkable thing. And yet, that's what the voice of God through Isaiah is saying here. Now we have a change of voice to that some non-specific person looking back on the ministry of Jesus and his life. But Lord, who has believed what they have heard from us? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And I've tried to paraphrase that to give you understanding there. But God, few if any of those who have heard us explain your purposes to them have believed us. If those who have heard do not believe, how can those believe who have not heard? See, he's just predicted that those who have not heard will understand. And what this voice is coming out saying, but wait a minute, I've been talking about this servant and explaining his life and his ministry and what he's all about to people, and nobody's believing me. So if people who haven't heard, or no, I'm sorry, if people who have heard won't believe what's going on, how are those who haven't heard, how are they going to understand? How are they going to believe? This gets quoted twice in the New Testament, in both cases, to explain that the unbelief of the generation of Jews in the time of the apostles, they say that was predicted, and they point to this verse and say, here is the prediction of the hardness of heart, of the dullness of hearing that's going to keep them from believing. So, but Lord, who has believed what they have heard from us? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And I think what he's getting at is, here is this lowly, humble, insignificant servant, and yet, to the one who has eyes to see, they see it as the very strength of Yahweh himself, the very arm of Yahweh himself. This is not an insignificant Palestinian peasant. This is the king of the universe, but you have to have eyes to see to recognize that's who it is. And so this voice is saying, but that, you know, I've been trying to explain to people that this is the king of the universe and they won't believe me. I've been trying to explain that this is the arm of Yahweh himself and no one is believing me. And if the people who have heard don't believe me, how is anyone else going to believe? Now he goes on, this same voice, I think, goes on to explain what it is, how it is that the generation of in Jesus' time responded to him, how they dealt with him, how they looked at him, in order to explain to God, they're not believing. Don't you understand? They don't believe this. He, and this is the servant that he's talking about, he grew up in the presence of Yahweh like a sapling, like a root emerging out of parched ground. He had no look or majesty that would induce us to notice him, nor any appearance that would appeal to us and attract us to him. He was despised and forsaken by men. He was a man of troubles, acquainted with our disease. I'm not sure how to translate that. It's literally a word for disease. I think he's using it as a moral disease, as our sin. In fact, that's how the Greek translation translates it on a couple of occasions here. But I just left it disease. He was a man of troubles, acquainted with our disease, like one of low stature from whom men look away. He was despised. We did not esteem him. So the point that he's making in this paragraph is, but God, the problem was, he wasn't a very compelling person. He was a pretty humble, no-account person. And people responded to him in the way that you would think they would respond to someone who had no esteem and who was a no-account person. They just ignored him. He was just invisible to them, God. He was no big deal. That's his first point. Then he goes on. Surely it was our disease that he himself bore. And that's the one where the Septuagint says, surely it was our sins that he bore. Surely it was our disease that he himself bore. It was our troubles he carried. But we esteemed him as stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. The point that he's making is, he's going to go on to talk about this servant dying. He's only intimating that now. He's not making that explicit. He's going to go on in a second to make that clear. He died. In dying, he was bearing our disease. But what did we do? We looked at him, Jesus hanging on the cross, and we didn't think, oh, there's the sacrificial lamb, the propitiation for the sins of the world, the high priest offering himself as a propitiatory offering to appeal to God for mercy, that's not what we thought. What we thought is, he's getting what he deserved. God really must be displeased with him. God is giving him the punishment that is his due. We did not see, we did not recognize that the death he was dying was not for himself. We did not see that the death that he was dying was a death he was dying for the sins of the world. So surely it was our disease that he himself bore. It was our troubles he carried, but we esteemed him as stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. He was pierced through, and I think that clearly is a reference to him dying. He was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. A chastening was delivered to him, which was to result in peace for us. By his scourging, we were healed. Yet, nonetheless, all that being true, that's what was really going on. But how did we respond? How did we look at this thing? All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. That is, I think what he's referring to is, but we missed it. You know, we looked straight at the cross, saw him dying there, and turned around and went, now how can I be justified in God's eyes? What am I going to do here? How can I find my way back to God? Like dumb, stupid sheep, we just wandered off and ignored the whole thing. Remember, he's describing the people of his generation and how they were looking at this thing. Yet all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, even though Yahweh had placed the iniquity of us all upon him. The thing you'll notice in all these paragraphs where it's this voice, this unspecified voice speaking, each one of these paragraphs is saying, look, here's what was really going on, and look how we missed it. Here's what was really going on, but here's how we responded to it. We were just blind. We didn't see it at all. The next one. He was harshly and unfairly treated, yet humbling himself, he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb being led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so did he not open his mouth. As for his sentence, he was forcibly taken away. And who among the people of his own generation considered that God had cut him off from the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke is due? Okay, see what he's describing. He's describing a scene where somebody is being brought into some, well, into a court situation, into some kind of situation of justice unfairly, but instead of opening his mouth to defend himself, he just stays silent, leaves himself completely without defense, leaves himself completely defenseless, like a lamb being led to the slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers. He did not open his mouth. He didn't do anything to try to stop this injustice that was going on, this travesty of justice. He just let it happen. So he was forcibly taken away as his sentence. But even though this went down this way, who among the people of his generation considered that what was going on is he was dying in order that the transgression of, I put this in quotes because it's now a phrase out of God's own mouth, the transgression of my people to whom the stroke is due. That is, but who of us ever really thought, considered the possibility that the stroke that he was receiving on the cross was the stroke that was due us as a people? We didn't even consider that an option. We didn't even think in those terms. Even though he himself had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth, his grave was assigned to be with the wicked. Or I think the Septuagint, the Greek translation, has the criminal. And that gets quoted once or twice in the New Testament, that he had to die like a criminal. His grave was assigned to be with the wicked, the criminal. He was buried with a rich man in his death. I don't know what to do with that. If I didn't know the story of Jesus, if I was just going on the Hebrew of Isaiah 53, I would go, what does being rich have to do with being wicked? Because it sure sounds like he's drawing some kind of parallel there. His grave was assigned to be with the wicked. He was buried with a rich man in his death. And I'm still inclined to think that something like that must be going on. It is curious that the tomb that Jesus was laid in was the tomb of an incredibly wealthy man, Joseph of Arimathea, who owned his own tomb. I'm not inclined to think that this is predicting that. I mean, the prophecy itself doesn't add anything to what he's saying. It doesn't in any way contribute to the point that he's making. So if it is, it's just a gratuitous prediction. Could it be a gratuitous prediction? Yeah, I suppose. But if so, I don't know where it's coming from.